If you could have found this all out on the internet, I would have been fascinated.
Yeah, I couldn't, because I actually went back and not to say that you, like, I didn't fact check you, but I went to get, you know, find a bit of context, you know?
No,
it's crack yeah, like up some is, of it's hard to find, yeah.
So much of this happened before the web.
Right.
No, that I, there actually are some old InfoMac, anyway, there's some old stuff you can find, but geez.
I was so happy when I got this too, because it'd been bugging me and I hadn't gone and figured it out, but I think I was talking to Gruber on his show at one point, and I was trying to name companies that sort of span out of like Apple or like in the like interesting like Palm style.
Oh, uh-huh. And so the General Magic stuff?
General Magic. Yeah, exactly. And that was exactly the one I was trying to think of, and I ended up saying like Handspring or something.
Oh, well, that came out of Palm, too.
Yeah, I know, but it was
the Palm guys
that General Magic with Magic Cap.
Yeah.
We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Today, we are talking to David Gelfman. How are you, David?
Oh, I'm fine.
That's the best answer ever.
What would you like?
These are multiple options. I didn't see anything.
Well, you know, doing well.
You got a lot of attention recently for a blog post, but I'm going to rewind heavily before that and just ask you, you have a rather storied career. How did you get involved? How did you get down the path to doing what you do now?
You really want me to start sort of early on, really early on?
Yeah, just what introduced you into, I guess, computing and maybe graphics and everything that you ended up working on?
Well, computing for me, it's sort of interesting because, you know, I graduated high school in 1975. And so in that time frame, you know, computing, the only thing I knew about computing was at my school, they had one class in computers. And I didn't get the chance to take it because it conflicted with a class in AP chemistry, which I wanted to take my senior year. So I didn't get to do any computer stuff really in high school at all. And except, and this was sort of a funny thing when I thought back on it, one of the kids that I was friends with at study hall used to bring his dad's HP 65 calculator, which was this like early, I don't know if you've even heard of it, but it was like the first programmable calculator.
Yeah, it was a reverse Polish notation, right?
Yeah, HP, you know, all their calculators were RPN, which I loved. And but this thing was programmable. It wasn't just a calculator. You could actually store programs in it and stuff. It had a little card reader that you could both read programs and you could write out the programs that you'd written onto the card reader so you could read them in later. So that was actually my first and only programming experience, you know, until I went to college. And, you know, the kinds of programs that you would write for something like that didn't have any graphics or anything like that, but it was just pure calculation kinds of things. You could enter some input and press a button and it would calculate some result that you'd, you know, program the steps for. So that was sort of programming in 1975, at least as far as I knew. And then when I went to college, you know, I was a physics major in college and I actually did do a little bit of computer stuff, but nothing formal in, you know, in the college, you know, classes or anything like that. All the classes for programming were in the electrical engineering department at that time. Anyway, so, but I had, you know, calculation kind of programs that I did, like for one of my professors, I did some work for him. It was all, you know, enter stuff on punch cards and send it over to the computing center and then pick up your printout later on. But it was always computational kind of stuff, which was really Fortran, you know, was the language of science at the time. Yeah. The only other language I'd heard of was assembler. And I actually did a little teeny bit in that, but, you know, that was totally different kind of animal and it didn't fit anything that I needed to do.
Yeah. Fortran's interesting because it is kind of still a lowish level language.
You know, if I remembered any of it, I might be able to comment.
It exposes some weird stuff. Like, I think everything's passed by reference.
Yeah, that is one thing that was pretty interesting to me when I started learning a language like C, which was, I just remember in the kind of computing that we did, we had like a common block, which was just, I guess it was a structure of some sort. But when you passed it to a subroutine, basically a subroutine could change anything in that. And when I actually started doing anything with C, I'm like, wow, you mean all these variables are local? And if I change them, you know, if I make a change to it, the next time I call the subroutine, the data's change. It's not, you know, it's not what it was the last. I mean, it was really weird to me because I'd just grown up with this other way. Now I think about it and using static variables is pretty, you know, something you generally avoid unless you have some real specific reason for it. But that was, yeah, it's exactly the way Fortran was. And column 6 was, a continuation column or something.
You know? Oh, yeah. Holy crap.
I mean, honestly, the last Fortran I did was probably 1984, 1985 or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I had to use it in one class one time and COBOL too at some point.
I never learned any of that. Yeah. That was a business thing. You know, scientists didn't do business. You know, I mean, I'm
good
saying
you.
It's
crazy.
Well, I just, you know, that's the way I thought of it at the time. You know, I was like, what? Really, until I, that was true. Then I, after college, I went to grad school at Stanford, and it was the same kind of thing. That all of the programming that I did was in support of doing calculations or data analysis, that kind of thing, monitoring equipment that we were using to take experimental data. So I didn't have any interest in the personal computers of the day, I would put it a different way. I didn't really know anything other than like when the IBM PC came out, and I had no interest in that at all. And it was just more kind of computing as far as I was concerned, of the same kind. I mean, I just didn't know why you'd be interested in such a thing. And that really all changed for me in 1984 because I was really lucky. I had actually been away when the Mac was introduced. I was in Germany for the experiment that I was working on. But when I got back, soon after I got back, I found out that one of my colleagues at Slack had he had a friend at Apple, and I'd heard of Apple. He had a friend at Apple who had, I guess, showed him the Mac, and he was just raving about how cool this thing was. So he was nice enough to come back up to Slack and give us a little demo, and I was just floored because this was so unlike anything I'd ever imagined or seen or, you know. It wasn't the kind of computing, obviously it was not the kind of computing that I was familiar with previously. You know, it was something really interesting. And the graphics obviously was a big part of it, but the whole thing just to me seemed just completely magical. You know, I mean, just I had no idea how this could possibly work. You know, just with my background, it didn't make any sense.
Right. Because, the interactivity of it is a totally alien to somebody who writes a giant experiment and has a computer crunch on it for like a day and a half kind of thing.
Well, we had dedicated systems and stuff. But, I mean, basically, there was no interactivity for anything that we did. Plus, there was no graphics like that. I mean, the kind of graphics that I was doing then were plotting data. You know, so you'd have charts and, you know, charts and graphs and that kind of thing. But nothing like what you would see with MacPaint. And, you know, when I was working on my dissertation, I was using Tech, which is still an amazing tool. But it was not any kind of WYSIWYG at all. And even previewing your Tech stuff came pretty late in my graduate career, you know, where you'd run your Tech stuff through a processor and then you could see it graphically on some other display. That was like, that was a way cool thing, but it wasn't like you'd interactively edit it. So seeing, you know, the Mac just totally changed my interest in computers and doing computing. It was like, oh, I was really drawn to that.
So you started to, you sort of put aside the heavy-duty physics computing and you got into the Mac side of stuff?
Well, I wouldn't say put aside because I still was going to finish my degree and I didn't have a choice. I mean, if I was going to finish it, I didn't have that choice. But what I did do is I started to learn about the Mac, you know, and tried to find spare time. I didn't want to work like nonstop on anything. So my physics stuff, you know, I would at the end of the day set aside. And so in the evenings I started like, well, one thing that happened is Stanford was one part of this original university consortium that Apple developed, where they had, I don't know how many universities, but Stanford was one of them where you could buy a Mac cheap. And cheap at the time meant $1,000. They were retailing for $2,400, which was, for me as a student, just forget that. But 1,000, I can figure out how to get. But I started going over to the library and reading Inside Mac. They had the loose leaf Inside Mac, so I started reading that, started reading about QuickDraw. I, you know, started playing with the programs, and then I got my Mac. And one thing that was pretty formative for me in terms of programming it was, you know, this is in 1985 at this point. This guy, Dave Wilson, did training, and he did this thing called Mac Africa. And it was around the time, I guess, of a big famine in Africa, and there was a big push to raise funds, you know, to to try and help people there. And so he came to Stanford, and he gave like a one-day thing. It was $100, something I could afford, like maybe $100. And I learned so much in that one day. You know, it's just like so different than like trying to read all of Inside Mac and figure everything out. So I just got totally hooked with that. And when I finished my degree, and or as I was finishing it, you know, I had known for quite a while that I didn't want to continue in physics. You know, I had a very strong idea of what that was going to be like in terms of how difficult it was going to be to find jobs, my level of interest in it. You know, I discovered over 6 years of getting a degree, you know, I just wasn't, it wasn't the thing for me to continue. Right. And the Mac sort of came around at just the right time for me because I was like, this is something so cool. I could see doing something with this. So as I was finishing my degree, I, you know, was doing some interviews. And at the time, you know, if you had a degree in physics, a lot of the work that was available was doing some kind of defense work. And, you know, in the Silicon Valley, you know, it of course, it's totally changed now, right? I mean, this is just, it's just night and day. But at the time, you know, the idea of being a programmer was a different idea. I didn't want to go and work in a in defense contract kind of work at all. And I had some interviews for some things that weren't, nothing that really got me excited. And then I got this just out of the blue, ran into somebody at Slack who worked in a different group, because I was overworking in physics, but I met somebody that worked in the computing center who had a project that they wanted to do that was a Mac-based project. And he basically was just as excited as I was that he'd met somebody that might be able to do this stuff. So it worked out that I was able to get that job. That was my first job after grad school, and it was still at Slack where I had been working as a graduate student, but now it was in a, you know, in the computing area instead of in the physics community. And so anyway.
That's cool. So what kind of, like, what kind of software were you writing?
Well, this software that he wanted was basically a piece of software that would interact with a piece of hardware that they were building, and it could monitor the hardware. It could read out data from the hardware, and then it could show you graphically stuff that it was reading out. Plus, you could control the hardware. So the part I remember, now remember this is 85, so it's a few years ago. The part that I remember is that, you know, I had built a graphical interface to let you control the hardware so you could set switches a certain way or things like that from a Mac UI. And that was pretty neat. And he wanted, this wasn't my idea, but he wanted the whole thing done in Forth. He was a Forth freak. I mean, he loved it. And I guess Forth ran on this piece of hardware as well. So one of the things that was sort of cool is I could send Forth commands to the hardware and have them execute on the hardware and then return.
Oh, data. That is pretty cool.
So the software that I was writing was actually Forth-based, and then you could send Forth commands to the hardware.
Oh, that's cool. So, this is going to come back up when you talk about DPS again, too.
Well, maybe a little bit.
Well, it's something that I liked about that, but we'll get
okay,
to it.
Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. That's actually a good point. Because to me, at least in this particular situation, being able to send the Forth was more... it was more of a curiosity because I don't think we ended up using it a lot, but yeah. I designed it so that I could.
Yes, it's a nifty thing to do.
It was sort of cute. One thing that was sort of cool about, you know, Forth itself, you know, it's again a reverse Polish notation programming language. It's not compiled, it's interpreted. But one thing that was sort of neat about it is I met these guys that did a really good version of Forth that happened to be in Palo Alto. They called themselves the Palo Alto Shipping Company. And I had started with a different Forth that I'll never remember the name of, but it was the one that was the sort of premier product at the time. But then these guys did this fourth that you could actually compile into machine code and run. So you could build, you didn't need an interpreter. If they had an interpreter, it was built into the binary that they built, but I don't think it was. That was actually pretty cool. The really good guys. And one thing that's pretty neat about it is they ended up, it turned out, I didn't know this until I started looking at this on the web recently. They were using the fourth that they were building and selling, you know, commercially, but they were using it to do their own work. So they were doing contract program for other people using fourth as their language of choice.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. And anyway, so that was sort of, you know, that was the project that I was working on at Slack. And one thing that was sort of fun while I was there, you know, it was total PC house. I mean, they had a mainframe, you know, IBM mainframe. That was the way things were done at the time. A lot of the experiments used VAX, DEC VAX computers. Stuff was starting to be networked. It wasn't necessarily, you know, I mean, it's totally different than today, certainly. But the cool thing was we started to get some traction with getting Macs used at the lab. And I had a lot to do with that because I was such a Mac proponent. And, you know, got very used to sort of hitting the headwinds of the IBM PC. But that was a pleasurable thing. And then I got an opportunity to go to work for Adobe. I actually interviewed at both Apple and Adobe. I got same time, I got an opportunity to interview both places. And the Adobe one worked out. And I started working in their developer support group. Mm-hmm. And this was 87. At this point. And, you know, Adobe.
Interesting time to be at Adobe.
It was a great time to be at Adobe. I mean, I felt like I was so lucky to hit the timing of this because, you know, I had gotten interested in PostScript. I guess I skipped this a little bit, but while I was working at Slack and doing this fourth project, the guy who I was working for, Dave Gustafson, he was a guy interested in a lot of different things. And we ended up getting a laser writer and I started learning, and this is in the early days of the laser writer. And I started learning PostScript because I just thought, you know, it was so cool to write just a tiny bit of code and get graphics to come out.
Yeah,
you know, it was not exactly what programming on the Mac. I mean, yeah, you could write code and get graphics to come out, but you didn't write like three commands and here's, you know.
Well, it was so straightforward, right? It was almost like Logo.
I never learned that, but I know what the notion of just programs that are sort of built to do graphics, you know. Yeah. Right. And that's exactly what PostScript was. So you could write little programs and pretty easily get some neat graphics, you know, to come out. So I had already learned PostScript, or at least I thought I'd learned PostScript before I went to Adobe. I found out, you know, lots more to learn. But and I got this opportunity to go there, which was, you know, like to me, off the charts awesome. It was sort of a mysterious company, you know. It was the company behind, at least at the time I was interviewing, it was the company behind PostScript. But PostScript wasn't, you know, Apple did the LaserWriter, mm-hmm. and that was the sort of customer-facing thing. And PostScript, if you knew a little bit, you knew that this was behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. But Adobe itself, you know, especially in the early days, was just behind the scenes. I mean, they really weren't out front. And I don't think they really got so much out front until Adobe Illustrator came out. You know, I mean, they had fonts, but when Illustrator came out, and it was, you know, the first version was just this unbelievable program for doing vector graphics, you know, for artists to do vector graphics. And Mike Schuster, who worked at Adobe, was the guy behind that. He and Warnock worked on that together. I mean, Mike Schuster did the programming. John Warnock was, you know, very much into the design. And I don't know if you ever saw it. It's on the web now. But the first version of Illustrator came with a little video that showed you how to do it. And Warnock was the person doing the demos.
Oh,
Warnock
was the
CEO of Adobe. He and Chuck Geschke founded Adobe. That you can find. And it's actually pretty neat. You know, it's real old and cheesy, but it's pretty, you know, and he knew what he was doing. I mean, he was involved with the design of the program, you know. So, you know, the opportunity to go to Adobe was like, oh my God, this was to me one of the premier companies at the time. You know, I mean, I knew something about them and what they were doing. I was really excited. So I went there and I started working in a developer support group, which our main focus was to work with third-party developers. You know, it's a little bit like was a little bit like Apple's DTS, but the number of customers was fairly limited. I mean, for me, I tended to work with the more prominent Mac developers. Okay. So
were these people who'd licensed your tech, or they were just using it on the Laser Writer? Okay.
Well, so that's a good question, Guy, because there were sort of the support groups at Adobe divided into two categories. They had what they called OEM support, and those were the people, the OEMs were the people that licensed PostScript and, you know, were working with Adobe to build it into their hardware, and there were, of course, a lot of support issues associated with that. That was a different group. The group that I worked in, developer support, worked with the third-party developers, so Aldus, Quark Express, you know, Quark, which did Express, is an example. Apple was one of the people that I spent the most time with because they had, you know, they had PostScript needs. They were generating PostScript to print, you know, to the Laser Writer and all other PostScript printers. So since I was sort of Mac focused, I tended to work with the developers that were doing Mac programs. And since the system software on the Mac, the Laser Writer driver, you know, sort of took care of it for almost every application. Mm-hmm. Working with Apple was sort of the prime, you know, contact that I had. But then there were some, like I said, Aldus and Quark, which, you know, they were like high-end PostScript people. Right. And they had greater needs. So I worked with them too to help them with their needs.
So they would effectively sort of bundle in their own driver that you'd help them debug and work out?
Well, Aldus had their own driver completely. Quark themselves, they sort of piggybacked on top of the Laser Writer driver, for better or for worse. that came back to haunt me,
later, I'm sure.
Say. But honestly, all I remember of those days for the developer support stuff had to do with those major vendors. There were others, you know, like people that worked more with the PC side of things. They were working with people like Lotus 1-2-3 or Microsoft, who was doing their driver, you know, as a system level driver for Windows, but that was a little later. You know, in the early days of PostScript, it's like on the PC side, every program that wanted to print had to somehow figure out PostScript for their program, for their application. You know, and so that was a different level of support. The driver, you know, for the Mac was, you know, pretty much handled it for every, you know, you do draw and it would generate PostScript. Yeah,
it just works basically.
Yeah,
I remember reading it. Yeah, it was the idea at least. I remember reading probably a Petzold. I'm pretty sure it was Petzold, but in PC Magazine. Around this time, HP also had a sort of a PostScript wannabe, right? The PCL.
Yeah. Let's see. What was it called? Jeez, I'm not going to remember what it was called.
Pretty sure it was PCL. It was like an incredibly boring name for printer control language.
No, they do have PCL. And that was that's still a language that they have.
So maybe I'm mixing it up then.
Well, they had another one that they were trying to do to compete with PostScript. PCL, I wouldn't describe as competing directly with PostScript. It wasn't sophisticated enough. But they were trying to do. It's so long ago, I don't remember the name of it. They were trying to do one. It wasn't. You know, they didn't. I mean, PostScript won that war.
You know? Yeah, yeah, and you could. It was. I remember reading the article, and I remember Charles Petzold, is a famous Windows author guy. Mm-hmm. He was into the HP one the same way that he was all excited about OS 2. Both decisions kind of didn't really pan out that much.
Well, I don't know anything about OS 2 other than it was reported to be pretty good.
I liked it a lot, but I mean, it went nowhere.
Yeah. One of the things about PostScript was that it didn't itself have a structure associated with it. Adobe came up with the notion of the document structuring conventions, they called it, which were to impose a structure to PostScript programs that made it possible to identify, you know, individual pages and what content a page might have, like the fonts that were required for a given page or
maybe we should just explain exactly what PostScript is, because I'm not sure if everybody knows. It's a very basic language. Well, I say basic, but it's a simple It's a simple idea for a language, right? Where you have a series of graphic commands like move to, line to, you know, various arcs. You can display text and you can say, okay, that's the end of my page. And there's a lot more to it, but that's the basic notion of the thing, right? But it's Turing complete in that you can jump around and you can do loops and conditionals.
Yeah.
It's which makes it really hard to sort of have certain expectations for any given piece of PostScript code, which is where I suppose this kind of document conventions come in, right?
Yeah. I mean, actually, you sort of identified a couple of different things there, because one of them is the structure and the other is, and it's sort of where PDF came in to change that, which was PostScript was just a freeform language. And, you know, you could have five lines of code that would draw, infinite number of pages.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you wrote your code that way, nobody would ever be able to separate pages or whatever and reorder them or anything like that, which was something that was potentially interesting. Mm-hmm. The language that you're talking about that HP did, that I'm totally blanking on the name, they actually, I think, made the structure part of the language itself. I think that was a contribution that they made. I don't know how the imaging model compared. I don't know any of that. But, I mean, it didn't go anywhere, which is part of why I don't remember very much about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just an interesting footnote. For some reason, I just remember, like, reading through the notes here, I just remembered HP doing something kind of similar. So,
yeah, they did. So one thing I just wanted to say about one of the best things that I really wanted to mention about when I first started Adobe, one thing is the company is 150 people, the company, and in the earlier days, they were growing the company very slowly, intentionally. They did not, there were a lot of times where people were just clamoring for more headcount, and they grew the company pretty slowly. But to show up there when there was 150 people, it was all one building, I pretty much at one point knew everybody. And so I got to spend a lot of time with the people that were, implementing the PostScript language and designing things, the language itself. But also one of the most fun parts of it was the developer support group was located just around the corner from the marketing communications group. And those people were responsible for creating the graphics that Adobe used to market their products, PostScript being one of them, but fonts, Adobe Illustrator, those were the only products in the early days. But they were using these tools to create these graphics. And these were artists using what were then, for the personal computer business, the state of the art of the tools for doing graphics. And they just did stunning work. And it was really a lot of fun to be around. I mean, I'm not an artist. I can draw graphics on the computer, but I'm not going to, I'm not an artist. And to be around people that were really so proficient with the tools, and also they had a lot of input. Russell Brown, who is one of the people that worked in that group, he had a lot of input into future versions of Illustrator and, when Adobe acquired Photoshop and so on. I mean, it was really a neat symbiotic relationship between that.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Really dog-fooding the products, really.
That, but more than that, in that they were pushing on what should be in the products. I mean, they had a built-in sort of,
focus group, maybe.
Pretty much. And, every now and then they'd run into a problem and they would come to somebody like me in developer support to say, hey, this isn't working right. I don't mean in the software, but I mean, like, when you got down to printing it and something was wrong and I could get in, I can look and help them out. So, it was really sort of a bonus of working, when you're working with a lot of engineering types, and then you also get a chance to sort of work with a bunch of artists. That was really a fun aspect of working there.
I'm not surprised you say that, because it's one of the things I really liked about working in the games industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's a bunch of programming guys around, and you're interacting with artists constantly, day in, day out, and it just kind of shakes things up, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, and then they're producing this amazing stuff that, I mean, anyway, I just, yeah. To see what they were doing with the tools that you were creating, I mean, that is just super.
Yeah, it's such a good feedback loop.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and they were driving it too, which was really sort of a cool thing to see, one thing I wanted to mention that was sort of cool, and I thought, you mentioned it just a little bit ago, which is Display PostScript. Because right around the time that I came to Adobe, maybe a little bit later, you know, Display PostScript, Adobe had already been pretty successful in the PostScript language and licensing it to OEMs, and it was sort of, it was really taking hold, I think. And they thought that the next step was, okay, let's turn this to the graphic software that drives the displays. Mm-hmm. And one of the big targets for that, well, first of all, they licensed it. DEC was one of the big licensees at the time, Digital Equipment Corporation, which doesn't exist anymore. But at the time, they had, you know, mini computers or maybe super powerful.
Yeah, they're pretty high-end stuff, yeah.
Adobe was hoping that they could get Apple to license Display PostScript and use that. I don't know if they thought
in place of QuickDraw or as
a. That's a great question. Yeah. You know, I think it would be, you know, what did they think? I don't know. Yeah. What would I have imagined if Adobe had been successful, what would it have turned into? The most I could have imagined was it was something in addition to QuickDraw. I mean, mm-hmm. in 87, 88, 89, you know, that time frame, QuickDraw wasn't that old. They just turned it, you know, they made color QuickDraw and 32-bit QuickDraw, you know, it extended it a lot. While I thought it was a really cool technology, I just could not imagine that Apple was going to license it. Apple, there was a certain tension between Adobe and Apple over a period of time because of PostScript licensing fees for the printer. Mm-hmm. And now you're talking about, you know, PostScript on the desktop, and PostScript had a reputation for being slow and certainly not at all what you want when you talk about a programming language for interactive graphics. You know, that's just a non-starter. But they had it running, you know, and
on the Mac?
They had it running on the Mac, yeah. I mean, cool. Yeah,
crazy, but cool. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't crazy because it was a big project. You know, yeah. I mean, it was part of their project. I mean, Next, they'd licensed Display PostScript to Next.
Yeah.
Next had made extensions to it. They'd added the compositing extensions that were never folded into the language, really, but they did their own thing with that.
I like it on the, for some reason, I don't know, it's one of those things that I really liked about the Next machines, mm-hmm. which is the Display PostScript model. Mm-hmm. I think mostly because it was really novel to me, and I just kind of found it a crazy idea that you could upload code.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What is it you liked about it? I'm just curious.
I think I had less experience, and I thought it was cool that you could upload code. And, of course, it was kind of dumb because you could lock up your display, right? Like, if you sent a series of commands that would print an infinite number of pages and you sent them to your display, guess what? Your display is just locked up now.
Yeah, well, they built in like a multi-threaded model into the language. You know?
Yeah, they did. There were steps taken so that kind of stuff wouldn't happen.
Well, your goal was to avoid it.
Yeah, exactly.
The world has changed in this regard. Now people are hacking people are doing hacks to try and, you know, break things. But there at that time, you know, the idea was to use the language as it was intended in order to avoid things like that.
Right, yeah.
But they sort of patched
one
on.
One thing I liked about the Next was the accelerator board that they did, because I just thought that was such a great idea, something you wouldn't see today. But basically, it was a graphics card that you'd stick in. There was a full computer that would just do the interpreting of Display PostScript and display it.
I remember they had some add-on card that they were touting for a while. Yeah. But I don't remember the details about it. I don't remember what was in it. I remember they were making a big deal about it. They also had RenderMan, that was a big thing that they were trying to push at the time for the Next machine.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I thought might be moderately entertaining is just a little bit about Mac Display PostScript, because I don't think there's been a lot talked about it other than maybe people at the time knew that Adobe was hoping that.
So I loved this kind of stuff and had no idea that it was ever running on the Mac.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the timing. I'm trying to remember if it was when I arrived or it was soon thereafter. But certainly at the time that Adobe was licensing it to Next, it was running on the Mac. And I don't know what the upfront efforts were with Apple to try and talk them into it, because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't working at that level of the company at all. But what I was doing was I was working with the third party developers that, you know, Adobe was working with on PostScript related stuff. And Adobe and Aldous had a really close relationship. Paul Brainerd, who, you know, founded Aldous, and John Warnock, I think they were really good buddies. And, you know, there was a lot of synergy between PageMaker and the LaserWriter or PostScript in general. They had a really good working relationship. And one of the things that that happened was that Aldous was, I think, seriously looking at licensing Display PostScript for the Mac for their own use. So, you know, it didn't look like anything was going to happen with Apple. And so I was working with the Aldous guys for their integration of the Display PostScript that Adobe had done for the Mac into PageMaker. And they had it running, you know. So the big thing about it was the type. You know, this was, I maybe back up a little bit and say, one of the biggest things about PostScript when it actually hit the market was that the quality of the type was really something not seen before on, you know, 300 DPI devices. The quality of the fonts that Adobe and others produced for PostScript, for PostScript printers was really excellent quality. And that was, I think, the primary interest that Aldous had in PostScript, was so that their text rendering, you know, that you could have really high quality text rendering when you didn't just have bitmap fonts, you know, at whatever size. You know, that's the way the world used to work, right?
Which is a great goal. Plus, I think if you're a hardcore graphics guy, the PostScript model makes a lot more sense.
Well, I think it fit more what they were doing in PageMaker too.
Sure.
Because, you know, things had gotten to a point where people were working around the limitations of QuickDraw. I mean, as great as QuickDraw was in its day, people were, you know, at the higher end were running into limitations of QuickDraw. And so they were running their own graphics, you know, graphics routines, you know, that, I mean, I know all of the Adobe stuff, that the only thing they used QuickDraw to do was to blit the graphics they'd already drawn using their own internal routines onto the Mac using copy bits. You know, they didn't use QuickDraw. I mean, I don't want to say they didn't use QuickDraw, but I mean, they, you know, Illustrator was written with a rendering engine, you know, that was a PostScript type rendering engine.
Right.
So, they had it. So basically, Aldous had it running. And I don't know what, I think at the time they were thinking of doing something like PageMaker Pro. So you'd have PageMaker, but they'd have the pro version that had Display PostScript running underneath. And, you know, the first time you see really high quality text rendering when all you'd seen was bitmaps before, it was pretty impressive. But, you know, it had some downsides for sure, because it had, you know, you're running a PostScript interpreter underneath. And, you know, the other thing besides text was the idea that you'd take PostScript graphics. There was a graphic format called encapsulated PostScript files that was sort of in the higher end graphic circles was the way you interchanged graphics. You know, QuickDraw had PICT, which was just a recording of QuickDraw drawing commands. Not necessarily bitmap. Not necessarily bitmap.
Okay.
PICT could be any, you know, it could just any QuickDraw captured graphics.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And
Microsoft had one too.
Yeah, I forget what it's called.
Whatever.
So there was this encapsulated PostScript, which was basically now there, it was a bunch of PostScript commands which drew a graphic. And then associated with this was like a PICT, which really was a bitmap, that was the graphic, you know, at low resolution. And you'd stick that PICT in your, you know, as a proxy. But when you'd go to print it on a PostScript printer, you'd get this really high quality graphic that was drawn by the PostScript commands that were backing up the bitmap graphic.
It's a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, so this was, you know, I don't think Adobe created that. I think it might have been Aldous, or it might have been one of the other high-end vendors like Quark or whatever in the early days when they, you know, you wanted to be able to interchange high-quality graphics, and PICT wasn't of sufficient quality for this. Really what ended up happening, and it sort of leads into, I would say, the rest of my career.
things heat up between the two.
Well, yeah, because at least the way I understood it, not from being inside of Adobe, but just what was reported in the popular press, was that Apple was fed up with paying licensing fees to to Adobe for PostScript. You know, they, I guess, you know, once it got so successful, and Apple sold a lot of LaserWriters, other companies did, you know, sold PostScript printers too, and the licensing fees were reported to be steep, and so they, you know, wanted to cut down on those fees. And I don't know exactly how it all came about, but basically at one point, Apple decided, okay, well, we're going to license this PostScript clone from Microsoft. Microsoft, I guess it started up some PostScript business. I don't know. You know, Microsoft did everything, right? So, you know, of course they had a PostScript clone over there that they, you know. So I guess Apple was going to license that. And they also were enhancing QuickDraw. They did this thing called QuickDraw GX, which was really just a total new graphics model. They just, the only fact that had QuickDraw in the name was the only connection to QuickDraw, really. And they were going to replace the printing system that existed on the Mac with the one that was in QuickDraw GX, which was supposedly more sophisticated and so on. And also they developed TrueType, which was a font rendering technology that was a outline fonts like PostScript TAD, that is vector, essentially art fonts that were vector art instead of bitmaps. And they were going to compete with Adobe's PostScript Type 1 fonts, or let's say replace the use of Type 1 fonts with the TrueType fonts. So I don't know. I think what happened is Apple did a deal with Microsoft. They gave them TrueType, and Microsoft was going to license PostScript, their PostScript, TrueScript or something. I don't remember what the name was. You know, and tell me, I'm sure I'm getting into this too much, but basically the outcome of all of it was that there was a lot of pressure on Adobe to not only compete with TrueType in some way, because Apple was going to build outline fonts directly into the Mac, but also to enhance the PostScript language so that, well, if you're going to license PostScript, well, what you're licensing is not the good stuff from Adobe. That was always true, but they were going to enhance the PostScript language to have more capabilities and whatnot. And that's sort of the beginning of my real career in software engineering, because I was very much involved with both the extensions to the PostScript language, because at that point I knew a lot about the language itself and what the deficiencies were, especially when trying to generate printing commands from the Mac from QuickDraw graphics, but just in general what the deficiencies were. For example, there was no notion of patterns in the PostScript language. The way you had to do patterns was almost a complete hack in PostScript, and that needed to be added. There was a lot of things that got enhanced in the language, and they Adobe called it PostScript Level 2 to say it's at the next level, I guess. And the idea was, well, why would Apple, who had been a partner with Adobe in buying PostScript from Adobe, why would Apple not want to get PostScript Level 2 instead of this old whatever Microsoft was peddling? And one of the flies in the ointment was that, well, Apple owned the LaserWriter driver. The LaserWriter driver was the thing that, you know, took the graphics commands that Mac applications generated and would translate them into PostScript so you could print. And if you didn't update the LaserWriter driver to use this new PostScript Level 2, then there wasn't really any reason to have PostScript Level 2.
Right. What originally made PostScript so great on the Mac and with the LaserWriter is now kind of standing in the way because there's a feud going on between Adobe and Apple.
Pretty much. Yeah. So, so to solve that problem, they said, okay, you guys, one of my colleagues at Adobe, who I really didn't know very well at the time, Richard Blanchard. He had done driver work, printer driver work for the Mac previously to coming to Adobe. And I knew the PostScript stuff. So he knew how to do a driver for a QuickDraw driver, and I knew PostScript, and I knew a lot about the LaserWriter driver. So they basically said, okay, you guys, make a new driver. Make a new LaserWriter driver was essentially what we were tasked with doing. And we started on that. And, you know, again, the goal was to use PostScript Level 2, as much as possible to enhance the abilities of it. Make it fast. Make it faster than LaserWriter driver so it was compelling to why you would want to use this thing instead of whatever Apple had. And use it as part of selling PostScript Level 2 to the vendors. Mm-hmm. So we started that project in June of 1990. And you guys tell me, do you remember an Adobe Developer Conference ever?
I do. I never followed it particularly. I was in PC land at this point. Oh, there was ever one?
There was one. And it was in June of 1990.
Okay, maybe I'm
confused. And it was basically because Adobe was introducing PostScript Level 2.
Okay.
And, it's a very different kind of conference than a WWDC conference because most of the vendors that were there, most of the people that were there were from the companies that were potentially licensees of it, you know. But, you know, we had sessions and whatnot. And so by that time, we actually had a driver that you could print from, you know, you could print basic text and certain graphics and whatever, and we could demonstrate that it was really a lot faster. Actually, the internal code name for this was called Screamer because our goal was to make it scream.
That's nice. So one detail about this is that you decided that you wanted to compute the PostScript output on the host rather than sending it to the printer, right?
Well,
because I think that's a pretty key technical decision that has, you know, still echoing today.
Yeah, to clarify just a little bit, Guy, the way the LaserWriter driver and an awful lot of PostScript drivers worked at the time was, well, PostScript's a programming language. So take your whatever it is you're trying to, your graphics that you're trying to draw, and then take whatever the graphics format you have is, together with a program that can sort of interpret that graphics format and then draw that on the printer. Mm-hmm. So that the computation was done in the PostScript language in the printer. Mm-hmm. And this is still true today. The hardware that's running on your desktop is a lot faster than the hardware that's in your printer. Yeah. It's just the case. And so one difference that we had with the LaserWriter driver, besides, you know, having a lot of PostScript experience myself, but one key thing that we were trying as much as possible to do is have less work done in the PostScript language. I mean, yeah, we use it as a programming language, but sparingly. Where you could get advantage by using the programming performance-wise, then yes, but you know, it's a lot easier to do multiplies and divides and whatever computationally in the host generating the PostScript that you're going to send to the printer than it is to do all the adds and divides and multiplies, you know, in the printer because you're running an interpreted program and the hardware isn't as fast as the hardware on the desktop either. So that was pretty much a design goal of the printer driver that we were working on, which was to...
But it turns out to be... So the reason I'm focusing on that is that it turns out to be an incredibly good decision because down the road, video cards end up being the same way in that it's better to compute it on the host and stick it into a texture and manipulate it using compositing on the GPU than it is to have some kind of GPU that's trying to interpret your graphics commands directly.
Well, this has been a real thing, you know, I'm skipping ahead just a little bit, but you know, one of the questions is, you know, like for example, how to accelerate how to accelerate 2D graphics on a, you know, personal computer now. Mm-hmm. And it's some of the same kind of thing. It's not that easy a thing to do.
No.
But anyway, so all right. So, you know, we worked on this printer driver project and one of the, you know, over time, and it took a while because you're basically replacing a piece of software that interacts with every application that prints on the platform, on the Mac platform, and all of their idiosyncrasies in the way that they interact with the existing LaserWriter driver. And the goal we had was to be functionally equivalent, plus to add features. We had some features that we were adding besides performance, among other things. One of the things we wanted to do was be able to generate encapsulated PostScript files and be able to take the printing stuff you were going to print and make a graphic out of it that you could later on reuse to drop into another application. So, you know, we were trying to add some things in addition to, you know, get really high quality PostScript out and very fast performance. And be compatible, and the compatible was the key.
Yeah,
so, you know, this ended up being a big project instead of a smaller project. And one thing that was great is that after about a year of this, and we were demonstrating to Apple, you know, what we were doing here and how much better we, at least we thought, and I think they agreed that what we were doing was than what they were already shipping. The other part of it was that they were working on Quickdraw GX, and they had taken their whole, all of their development effort on anything related to printing, and they'd poured it into Quickdraw GX. So there was no question that the traditional Mac, if you want to call it Mac Classic, that's probably a bad word to use now, the Mac, you know, Quickdraw printing system that existed prior to Quickdraw GX, that was being totally neglected because of the Quickdraw GX effort. And so we were essentially...
A lot of bad decisions at Apple at the time.
Yeah, well...
Shoot the moon engineering, really.
It did, exactly. So basically we ended up being their printing team because Adobe and Apple struck a deal where we at Adobe... continued to work on this LaserWriter driver substitute. At Adobe, it was called PS Printer. And Apple was going to ship it. And so they provided to us as their effort, you know, it ended up being a joint engineering project. And the way it became a joint engineering project was Apple provided all the testing. I don't want to say all. Apple provided a huge amount of testing help, which was fabulous because, geez, think about testing all these apps with, yeah, you know, what with this new driver. Plus, they gave us access to the LaserWriter source code to look at for, you know, issues that related to compatibility.
Right.
And there were plenty. Yeah. Now, the LaserWriter code at that time was all assembly. You know, 68K assembly. This was 1990, 91, that time frame, way before PowerPC. So it was all 68K assembly. And so, you know, actually a big part of my role with the project was where we needed to figure out what the LaserWriter was doing in some oddball case. It was figuring out what the hell it was doing from the source. I shouldn't say it was all assembly. There was a lot of assembly. What wasn't assembly was Pascal.
Right.
So
it's like the Pascal defines the functions and then just everything else is assembly. And
no, I honestly, I don't remember anymore. Okay. So, it was a long project. It ended up shipping pretty much in the same time frame as PostScript Level 2 did, which was in the 92, 93 time frame. I don't remember exactly. But there was a lot of pressure on us. Pardon me?
Yeah. I'm trying to line it up with a Mac OS release. 7, 6?
Well, it was, let me think. It had to be 7.
Yeah.
It had to be 7.
Whatever. Something for the
7
listeners.
Something, you know, so, 7 yeah. Something. I don't remember. And one thing that was interesting is that at that time, see, the driver was decoupled from the OS. I mean, as the OS got updated, there might be some things that we would add to the driver, but we actually weren't. This is one thing that made development a lot easier, and certainly that this changed as time went on, which was to work on the printing system. We could do a lot of work independently of OS changes when we're working on just this driver.
Right. Yeah.
You know. But, you know, there was a lot of pressure on us in terms of time because the goal was to ship this when PostScript Level 2 shipped, and at the same time it had to work as well as the LaserWriter driver or better and so on. So
yeah, and it's a big bet for the company, right? So.
Yeah, well, PostScript Level 2 sure was. I mean, at that time, PostScript was still the big moneymaker for Adobe. You know, things had not, you know, obviously that's changed dramatically, but...
But Level 2 is far less useful until you can actually use it on a, you know, in the field.
Absolutely, you know. So, why do you want to license it if there's no obvious benefit to, you know, nobody's really using it. It was a chicken and the egg thing, which is why the driver project existed at all.
Yeah.
You know. So one thing that was sort of cool was this is also around the same time frame as PDF is being created at Adobe. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask because a lot of the sort of conceptual problems with PostScript and display PostScript must have been sort of coming to light as you're designing PS Level 2.
What's true is that it was pretty clear that display PostScript wasn't going to take over the world.
Yeah.
You know, no way. And so you weren't going to have like some client that could render, like every client could render PostScript graphics. That was not going to happen. And, you know, the interchangeability of content PostScript was actually a at the time was a really relatively portable way of taking a document and handing it from person to person, and they could then print it. You could just mm-hmm. send the PostScript to the printer, and you
high know, fidelity documents, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. And all the layout was already done. Everything, right? So, but you couldn't see it on the screen unless you had a PostScript interpreter, and that wasn't going to happen everywhere. And you know, there are an awful lot of things about PostScript that weren't particularly practical for things like searching text and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So. I can't speak a lot to the origins of PDF, really where it started. I'm sure Warnock had a big hand in it. He gave a lot of talks about what he called ASCII jail. We're all in ASCII jail. You know, the only way you can send something from person A to person B is to put it in ASCII, because if you do anything else, then, you know, no, they're not going to be able to see it the way it originally was, you know, formatted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, PDF came about as a way, well, originally there were talks about making it, you know, an editable interchange format. That was clearly too big a task to take on, and it mm-hmm. became a non-editable, well, I mean, you can edit it, but as a general rule, just a way of taking the document and handing it from person to person. You know, it's been incredibly successful. Mm-hmm.
I think that scope of making it not editable is probably the right decision.
Well, I mean, it was the only way also, it was the only practical one at the time, that's for sure. Because right. as soon as you add editability, now there's this whole range of problems you're going to try and solve. And that was just beyond what was yeah. reasonable to solve in any kind of reasonable time frame. Yeah. And I mean, what is the editable format now? Microsoft Word? I mean, what is an yeah. edit? You know,
well, that's general... it. So I don't, there isn't one. And I think it's almost an unsolvable problem, right? So.
Well, and good that Adobe didn't try and force that to be the solution in 1993 that they were going after and never would have solved. Or I don't want to say never would have solved, but they weren't going to ship it in 1993.
Right. You know?
So, you know, that that driver project was pretty much my undoing it at Adobe, just because of the stress involved with that project and some just mismanagement.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Just burn you out?
Well, there was a bunch of mismanagement. There's a lot of stress that was, you know, pressure that was put on in terms of being able to deliver. I have a little story, if you'll indulge me. You can edit it.
That's
if you
what
decide.
We're here for.
Okay, you can edit if you don't like it. But this, I think, was representative of the mismanagement. You know, we had, you know, it got to the point where, you know, there's a lot of pressure to ship this, you know, in such and such time frame. So they were having regular 8 a.m. meetings every day where they would go over the status of this project. So my manager at the time was going to these meetings at 8 o'clock and reporting about the project. And, you know, I don't know about you, doing daily status reports isn't going to, like, get the job done. That doesn't get the job done any faster. It's just...
So it's going to make it worse. Yeah.
Well, you know, all you're doing is writing your status report.
Right.
So one time he comes back from, you know, we thought things were going pretty well. It looks like our bug counts were down. It seemed like we're, you know, zeroing in on, you know, getting the software finished. And he comes back from one of the meetings and he says, oh, geez, you know, I just reported to these guys today. You know, things are getting worse. You know, at the rate things are going, it's going to be, you know, whatever amount of time before we're done. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, things are going better. Bug counts are down. He said, well, look, I've worked the numbers, and here's the projection of when we're going to be done. And I looked at what he had, and I said, Jimmy, show me, how did you generate this chart or whatever it is he had? And how did you generate? He said, oh, I wrote an awk script to take the bug counts and, you know, project out. And I said, can I look at your code? And I didn't know awk. Can I look at your code? And I looked at it, and he had the, like, in his calculation for projecting out, he had the numerator and denominator of the equation so that the faster we were fixing bugs, the longer it was going to take us to finish. And I was just like, I looked at this and, you know, and by the way, you know, it's not like this is the first time this particular person had, you know, like done something that made it yeah. impossible, but so
I can't believe this.
It you know, and by the way, that's bad.
That really
enough.
Is mismanagement. That's just wrong management. It's like provably mathematically wrong management.
Well, Yeah, but look at it this way. If all he'd been doing was giving us internal reports on our team, and this had been the case, that would have been one thing. But every morning he's going at 8 in the morning and telling upper management at Adobe, this is how the projects go.
Oh my God.
I'm just like... So anyway. Yeah, you know, it's like, okay, well, we better stop fixing bugs, because the more bugs we fix, the longer it's going to take. So anyway. So
to be fair, his management should have spotted that what he was saying wasn't making sense.
So Gus, you know, I'm just not all that interested in being fair.
Right.
Okay. Now, probably, you know, I'm sure that, you know,
yeah,
look, what can I say?
Yeah.
And let me also say, I worked with some really great people at Adobe, both on the team and other managers that I had at Adobe. I had some really good ones. But the engineering management on this project was abysmal. Working under that kind of stress with those kinds of screw-ups takes a toll.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
So you
rage quit.
No, I wouldn't say that. But
yeah,
basically,
I'm
the driver, you know, we finished up the driver stuff. I took a six-week, you know, sort of sabbatical. I took 6 weeks, you know, part of it was time off, and just to get away and sort of got relaxed. And then I came back, and 2 days after I got back, there was already some emergency crisis. And I'm like, yeah, back in the totally panicked, you know, running around, you know. So I lasted about 6 more months at Adobe. And, you know, part of the reason that I left was this. And another part of it was I got a really good opportunity, or at least what I thought at the time was a good opportunity, which was, I got approached by somebody that I used to work with at Adobe, who was working at a company called General Magic, which was, in retrospect now, one of the storied failures of Silicon Valley,
yeah,
but at the time was doing some of the greatest, coolest stuff on the planet. They had just an incredible team of all-star people that had been put together. They had two separate products that they were working on. One was called Magic Cap. And one that
which
was called
pen-based computing, right?
It was pen-based computing. It was, you know, the two people whose names sort of grabbed your attention at the time were the two of the founders were Bill Atkinson and Andy Hertzfeld, who were formative members of the Mac team. You know, I got an interview over there. Andy demoed Magic Cap for me. You know, he demoed it running on a Mac, but, you know, they clearly had it running on a device as well. And it was really amazing. Anyway, you can go look up Magic Cap and look at some of the demos and stuff.
The people that were there are pretty heavy hitters.
Well, you know, the thing about it is at the time, I thought of Andy and Bill as the big heavy hitters. But after I was there for a while, I realized there were quite a few others. One of the people who I just thought was an amazing guy was Phil Goldman, who he had actually, if you remember this product that Apple had, became part of the Mac called MultiFinder. He was one of the authors of that. It was sort of Andy Hertzfeld's switcher program, but it basically made the Mac look like it was a multitasking computer. With multiple, you know, windowed system that had multiple applications running at once, and you could see the windows for all applications at the same time and stuff, which at the time was not the way the Mac worked before. But Phil, who was just an amazing guy, but it ended up being, you know, an all-star group of people. But I didn't know most of these people before I came there, and it's sort of interesting what came out of it. Some of the things that came out of it were, you know, well, Pierre Omidyar, who started eBay, and Andy Rubin, who he started this company called Danger, and later they had Danger phones, and obviously was sort of the seminal force behind Android, which ultimately was bought by Google, and, you know, we know what's happening with Android now. Chris McCaskill started this company called SmugMug, which is really one of the premier photo publishing sites on the web.
Yeah.
Bill Goldman, Steve Perlman, Bruce Leak. Bruce Leak had been one of the QuickTime architects at Apple. He was at General Magic when he left there. He and Steve and Phil started this thing called WebTV that later on got bought by Microsoft.
Microsoft, yeah.
Yeah, Kevin Lynch, who's been in the news a lot lately because he was at Macromedia and ultimately Adobe, worked on Flash, certainly became a figurehead for Flash. I don't know exactly what his role in working on it was, but he was a general
manager. Yeah, I feel that maybe he got a little bit tarred over that. Maybe unfairly, I don't know.
He's become a figurehead for Flash. Whether that was justified or not, I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he made the video, so he earned it.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's been doing interesting stuff. I mean,
yeah.
This is an all-star cast.
Yeah.
It was an all-star cast of people. And Magic Cap, it was amazing software. I think the thing about it is the time frame we're talking about, 93, 94, 95, the hardware wasn't anywhere near where it needed to be. Mm-hmm. You know, the size of a Magic Cap device, I'm sort of putting my hands out trying to estimate the size. Maybe it was like 8 inches by 5 inches, maybe, I don't know. It was really thick. It was maybe an inch and a half thick or something like that.
If I remember right, it's almost like, you know, when the UPS guy hands you a device?
Yeah, it's pretty much that size.
It's almost that bulky, yeah.
It was about that bulky. It only had a telephone input. You could get one of the first ones that shipped from Motorola had wireless, but wireless was a fortune. There was no World Wide Web. Telescript, which was this language that General Magic was creating, and that's actually what I got hired into, was to do developer support for that. Telescript was being used by AT&T to make a service, a mail service, plus they were going to do other things as well, that the Magic Cap device was going to talk to. So that's how you're going to have your email, was through AT&T Personal Link, is what it was called at the time. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this was really before the web. And you know, they were really, and it was way ahead of its time, before the hardware, before the communications had gotten to the point where it really needed to be to make such a product, viable. It was just way too big, too. I mean, you're not going to, you know, when Palm came out, I mean, that was really the device that took the world. When they came out with their devices, you know, that was something you could hold in your hand, you could put it in your pocket. The Magic Cap device was a big device that you pretty much had to have some kind of handbag. You know,
fair to say that Palm took a lot of ideas from Magic Cap and General Magic.
I don't know, you know, because I didn't start getting into that. I wasn't that interested in Palm. You know, it wasn't anywhere near. I mean, Magic Cap was like this thing where, you know, you had a desk in front of you and had a telephone. And if you wanted to make a phone call, you touched the telephone and the telephone would expand out and it had your contacts. And it was pretty well done. Visually, really interesting, very smooth. You know, they were onto a lot of stuff. It had a stylus. That was the hardware of the day. You know, anyway,
I think it was
ahead of its time. Definitely a lot of good people came out of it. I mean, I mentioned the people that you've heard of. There's a lot of people you've never heard of that have gone on, done really great work, and a really talented group of people there. It wasn't really a good match for me. I was working on this other stuff called Telescript, and I think the fact that it had the word script in the word was sort of why they thought, well, I had done developer support. I knew how to work with third parties. Yeah. You know, I had done engineering work and I could do things from that point of view, but it really wasn't something for third parties to work with, it turned out. Pierre, who ultimately started eBay, he had been working. The company that he worked at, which was called eShop, they were my only developer that I was working with. I had third party developers. They were really the primary one, and they were trying to build a shopping service kind of thing that was going to be visually based. You were going to walk through their stores, like a little virtual reality store you walk through, and you know, I mean, they were very ambitious too. People were very ambitious.
It was the 90s.
Yeah, wasn't very practical, it seemed.
That's okay, though. That's part of the learning, like the communal learning about how stuff should be or how it could work, you know?
I think you're right, but I got to tell you that at that time, I was very focused on making sure that a product was going to be successful.
Right.
And when it didn't seem like it was very practical for me, that didn't fit me very well.
Don't get me wrong. I'm the same way, and like I'm very product oriented.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, as I don't think this is necessarily a misstep in history. I think the work that went on here is all interesting, and it's informed other work.
Well, let's just say, you know, Pierre, you know, he left that company. They ended up selling that company to Microsoft, actually. But he left that company before they sold it and came to work in developer support at General Magic to do Magic App support for third parties. And he was at, this is after I had left General Magic, but he was at General Magic when he developed eBay. You know, I mean, people absolutely learn from, you know, their mistakes or what they've done in the past, for sure. Just as somebody doing developer support, when you see that the one developer that you're trying to support is, you know, it doesn't look very practical. Mm. The technology that you're providing and what they're doing didn't seem very practical. I didn't feel very successful there.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, be depressing. So you've age quit. I'm kidding.
No, you know,
I'm kidding. I'm really teasing.
My experience. No. No, I mean, I left on amicable terms and it just wasn't a good match for me. Plus, you know, here I am living over in Santa Cruz and I had to drive every day to get to the office. You know, I had been working at home a lot prior to that. And so it just wasn't a good match for me. So I was there almost 2 years. And just decided, you know, it wasn't working for me. And what I ended up doing when I left there, which sort of led into my latter part of my career, or really the most interesting part of my career, was Rich Blanchard and some of the people that I had worked with at Adobe had left Adobe, but they'd started a contracting company, consulting company, and they started doing continuing work on the printer driver work that we had done while employed at Adobe. But both Adobe and Apple had, because it was a joint development deal, they both had rights to the source code for this software. We didn't have rights to the source code. They owned it. But since we had the knowledge, we had developed the software, we had the opportunity to do software development, continue software development on, but do it as contractors. So in 95, when I left General Magic, I went and started working with Rich and his company. It was called RBI Software Systems. And we did contracting work for both Adobe and Apple. And we had other companies too. And the most interesting one was Sun, because we did the Java 2D printing system that basically when they integrated printing into Java 2D, that's we wrote the software for that. We designed and wrote the API and the software for it. We wanted to do B. At that time, BOS was like potentially a really hot thing. You know, they were doing really cool software. Who knows what was going to happen with their hardware? Do you guys remember B?
I was a huge absolutely. B fan. I really wanted to buy a B box. Like, you could pre-order them for a while. They had a specific video card in it, which I'm forgetting, that I went out and bought from my PC just because I was like, well, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. I was a huge, huge fan.
B was sort of like between Next and B. Those were the two operating systems that supposedly Apple was considering when they were going to, when the Copeland project fell apart and they were going to license or buy another company. B was, Jean-Louis Gasset's company.
Yeah.
Anyway, we wanted to do that. We somehow didn't know the right people to get connected to do the printing stuff for B, because that was our specialty. And, we knew how to do both APIs and the software underneath them and stuff. And we thought it was
one of the issues with B was, well, A, it was single user at a time when it was looking like that was going to be limited. But I think one of the negatives was that they didn't have great printer support as compared to what Mac currently had. Like, it would need to be something that they worked on.
Well, Guy, you can recommend me.
Okay. I'll call up Jean-Louis. Yeah. Me and him are tight.
We just didn't know the right people to talk to. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, wait, if Palm owns it, doesn't that mean HP owns it now? So it's kind of full circle?
That's true that Palm bought it, and I had no idea why they bought it when they bought it. And I had a friend that worked at Palm around that time. And I'm like, why in the world did they buy it? What in the world?
I don't know if they knew.
I mean, to me, it made sense that HP bought the Palm software. That made sense to me, although what they did with it didn't make any sense to me, but that made sense to me. But this, I never understood the B thing. So, what ended up happening, ultimately, so we're at RBI and we're working on, updating the printer driver software, plus doing some stuff for some other companies and whatever. And we were pretty busy doing that. I mean, we got a lot of work from both Adobe and Apple. And but, you know, 1996, 1997, Apple bought Next, or Next bought Apple, or whatever, the companies merged. And, you know, at that point, it looked like Display PostScript, which is what was running on the Next box, that maybe Display PostScript was going to now all of a sudden be the graphics language of choice for
it's
the
funny because operating system. This is when I get excited about it. And well, because I'd never really had access to it before, and I was like, "Oh, cool! I'm going to get to play with it." And
hey, you could have bought the Next software. You could have bought OpenStep and put it on a PC if you'd wanted.
Yeah, but $10,000 at that point of
was
my
that what it cost
career.
To get a license?
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I didn't know about the software. I know, you know, when they were selling their boxes.
$10,000. It was expensive. It was more expensive than I was going to pay. Yeah. And I was paying like around that time, I paid $700 to IBM for a compiler, C compiler. Like, things were not cheap in those days.
Wow.
Anyway, yeah. So I had
that. Paying IBM, that's another matter. I mean, jack up the price.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, but. Yeah, so it's funny because you're depressed. This is coming back, and I'm like, oh, cool.
No, I wasn't depressed it was coming back. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't depressed it's coming back. As a matter of fact, it was potentially a real opportunity for somebody like me who is a PostScript expert. You know, I mean, it could have been that it was going to generate a lot of work. I think what I was depressed by, and just about everybody in the Mac community was depressed by, was how poorly Apple had been doing, you know, and it. Yeah, I don't know if the story that Steve tells is true, that Apple is 90 days away from bankruptcy and all of that stuff. You know, I have no idea. It's a great story.
It doesn't matter if it's true. Exactly. It feels
true. It's a great story, and it's close enough to being true based on just the feel of things was not very good. So, you know, we're like, prior to this, we're thinking, okay, well, you know, what happens if Apple doesn't make it? Are we going to be a window shop? None of us could stomach the idea of that. We just didn't want to do that kind of programming. So, you know, Apple and Next merged, and maybe Display PostScript is going to be the thing of choice again. And
they did ship a product on it, right?
Yeah, I heard you talking with Daniel about it. I didn't remember
that.
What you'd said, but I believe you.
Yeah. And in fact, OS X up until DP3, Developer Preview 3, was shipping with Display PostScript.
That I knew, but what I didn't realize that they'd shipped a 1.0. You said in that other podcast that they shipped a 1.0 with Display PostScript.
Yeah, which is crazy. Yeah.
And I'd forgotten that completely.
That's okay. Nobody bought it except like disaffected Next people.
Well, look, I don't want to say, I don't want everybody to think that I thought Display PostScript was terrible. I just personally thought that there was a better model. The PostScript imaging model was great.
Yes.
And the thing with Display PostScript was that in order to draw anything, you had to package up your drawing commands and send them to the Display PostScript server that was running inside your box. And it was going to interpret those drawing commands and then render the graphics to the display.
Now, to be clear, I think that I thought that was neat.
Oh, I think it's neat too.
Which is the stupidest way to design it. Hey, that's kind of neat. You know, no. I've since learned that that's the dumbest thing to do.
Just as an example, you know, like I said, my friend Rich, who, you know, I've been working with for a lot of years, he was working on some software for the Next box, and he was asking me, you know, for some tips of, you know, how could he get images to go faster? And I'm like, with all kinds of ideas, and he tried every damn one of them. None of them would make it go fast, because basically you had to send your image to the server, you know, and as opposed to just, you know, anyway. So it really didn't turn out to be a very practical solution, in my opinion. I mean, the notion that you could send your program across the network and have it interpreted, well, that's sort of cool.
That was one of the cool things I liked, is you could run your app on another machine over the network, and it would render as if it was rendering locally.
Yeah, it had some, I don't know. I'm not a fan of it in terms of as a practical solution for real world problems.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, it's better than X Windows.
Pardon me?
It's better than X 11, I guess.
Well, yeah. So, but that's what DEC did, is they built it on top of X 11. When Adobe licensed Display PostScript to DEC, they built it on top of X11 in some way. So it was that model, but it was with the PostScript imaging model. But you still had the whole send your PostScript program to the server, and it would, you know, it was the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, regardless, I mean, the crown jewel is actually the imaging model.
That was my opinion. You know, when I was at Adobe, I talked to a bunch of people about the notion that, why don't we have an imaging, you know, library instead of display PostScript? That's really what you want for the desktop.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, turns out it's a good idea.
It's a great idea, isn't it?
As the story unfolds, we'll hear more.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're at RBI cranking away on stuff. And Apple is going down the drain and then grabs onto the life raft that is next. And what happens?
Yeah. Well, so I guess, you know, at some point it became a little bit of a black box to us because it just wasn't clear exactly what was going to happen with the way this was going to be put back together. You know, we were starting to look at some of the printing code for the next, essentially next OpenStep or the next OS, or it's called anymore. We were looking at that, and it was, you know, it was a very ancient kind of thing. And, you know, I guess I'll forward a little bit and just say, well, what popped out of all of this, even though Apple originally looked like they were going to stay with the display PostScript route, but maybe with some extensions, is they decided, and I'm so thrilled it worked out just fabulously, in my opinion, is they wrote their own imaging library that was based on the PostScript imaging model, or the PDF imaging model by that point. They called it Core Graphics, or Quartz 2D. And I looked at that and I'm like, this is exactly what I was hoping would happen, you know? And well, I know better how it happened now, because, you know, when Apple and Next merged, a bunch of really smart people from Next came over to Apple. At this point, the QuickDraw GX system was dead and gone. That was not going to happen. That had already been canned. Yeah. But the team...
That was one of the things that Steve got booed on stage for when he gave that Q&A.
Is that right? I didn't realize.
Yeah, pretty sure. Yeah, it was like open doc and the QuickDraw GX.
I had remembered GX being gone before then, but I believe you. I mean, I just... I didn't talk about any of the bets that I've made over my career. I bet against this PostScript. In the early 90s, I had a bet with a colleague at Adobe saying, there's no way Apple is going to license display PostScript from Adobe. He said, oh, I'll bet you on that. And I said, okay, well, we got to set a timeline on that bet, because I can't say never, you know, I mean, I got to collect sometime. So we made it 2 years and I won that bet, which was a burrito. It's my standard stakes. Well, the funniest thing is when Next and Apple merged, and it looked like Display PostScript was now going to be Apple's graphic system on the Mac, the same friend sent me a message saying, and of course, this is like, I don't know how many years later, 8 years later, so they're like, hey, looks like I'm right, you know. No, you're not.
That's awesome. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
So out falls Quartz 2D.
Out of this all falls Quartz 2D, which I think is just tremendous, you know. Yeah. And the genesis of that is, well, you know, the Next team comes over, and I think at that point, again, I don't have the inside info on how that actually came about, but I think they pretty much realized Display PostScript was not what they wanted to be building in on the Mac platform at that point. Even though they shipped the developer previews, like you said, absolutely true. So they wrote their own library, and they made it using, you know, they built the imaging model using the imaging model of PDF/PostScript graphics, and made it a client library. It's a lightweight, you know, rendering library. And Peter Graffinino, who was one of the Next people that came over, he had been the graphics guy at Next. He was the person that I remember people at Adobe working with, among others, on the Next software, you know, when they were doing Display PostScript. And Peter, who was, I think, just super brilliant person, you know, basically, you know, we had gotten an offer from Apple. Apple basically said, hey, we're not going to be able to continue to pay you contracting dollars. You're like the number one contractor dollar-wise, saying to RBI, we want you to come and work for us instead of work as contractors. And that's what we ended up doing. Was, not everybody, but most of the people on the team came to Apple as employees in June of 2000.
And break. We kept talking to David for about 3 hours. And since that's way too long for a single podcast episode, we decided to split the show into two. So we're going to continue debugging David about his years at Apple and his final project, AirPrint for iOS. And that will be coming to you in a separate show really, really soon.